Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 67 for May 2nd, 2009. Zen. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the 2009 Google Summer of Code Project. The Google Open Source Program has announced the student projects they accepted for 2009, and their students are now busy coordinating with their mentor organizations and getting their code work underway. Get involved in the open source community at code.google.com/SOC and tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free, Libre, open source software each and every week, with our host, Randall Schwartz of Stonehenge.com, the Pearl Master, the expert in Squeak and Seaside, the man who is on the Linux. What are you, the Linux board? What is the board you're on?
I'm on the Linux Fund board, which is great because I get to give away money to worthwhile projects.
Now, I just saw a tweet, by the way. He is on Twitter as M-E-R-L-Y-N.
Yes.
I just saw a tweet from you saying if you have a Linux credit card, get a new one now or what? Doesn't it no longer benefits the Linux Fund?
If you have the old card, if it's a Visa card, it's not going to work. You need the new MasterCard. If you go to the, I may have that backwards. Anyway, if you have a card from more than a year ago, even though it still has the penguin on it, you're not actually contributing because they stopped the program. So if you have not applied for the Linux Fund, I think it's the Visa card. You know, I should know this better now that I'm on the board. But if you haven't applied in the last year, you're not actually helping our program out. So,
is there a new program? So you could apply now. And
Yes. The cutover was only down. It was only down for like a month. But the problem is that the old card still have. There was no notification that it no longer goes into the Affinity program anymore. So you don't know that you're not applying. So please, so if you have the old MasterCard,
it's a Visa.
Switch. You want to get a Visa, and if you don't have Visa with the penguin on the front, please apply now. Also, for those of you that are much more BSD rather than Linux, I don't know if I should announce this ahead of time, but actually, by the time the show goes out, it'll be on the website. But we're getting a BSD devil on the cards.
That's a tough choice.
Yes.
Can I get both?
You certainly ask for both. Certainly, there's no problem with that. And like I said, some small percentage. I would like to say it's around 1%, but it's somewhere in that ballpark. Of everything you spend with that card goes to promoting open source projects. And I'm on the board of a group that gets to actually help decide how to spend that. So that's very cool.
Now, let me really confuse you. If you're in Canada, it's a MasterCard.
Yes, that's the old program that still works.
In Canada,
it
works.
In Canada, yes.
So if you're in Canada, use the Linux Fund MasterCard.
Yes.
If you're in the U.S., use the Linux Fund Visa card. And if you don't have one, why the heck not? Don't you want tux on your credit cards?
Exactly. And you're funding open source projects all across the board. If you go to the website, linuxfund.org,
no additional cost to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
At no additional cost to you.
Indeed. Indeed. And follow me on Twitter and you'll find out more about things like that. In fact, I just recently appeared in Minneapolis talking about open source software, talking about Smalltalk and Seaside and why dynamic languages rule the world. I'm going to be making that talk available online. If you followed me on Twitter or if you watch my blogs, you'll see the actual, maybe some video. I'm taping a little ahead, so I can't tell if I actually took some video of this talk, but if not, we'll be doing it again.
You're committed.
But I could at least publish the slides. The slides will be published under a Creative Commons license so people can reuse it and share the slides as they wish. And if I've done video, I'll put that under the same Creative Commons. So, because really, I want people to know why dynamic languages rule the world. You know, stuff like Smalltalk and Perl and Ruby and Python and things like that. I really want people to understand that the restrictions that Java and C# and C++ and all that put on us over the years sort of slides us a little backwards. And I have some pretty good things to say about that. So they're in the materials here. And I know I had a great time in Minneapolis. I can already tell.
So for people, for dunderheads like me, of which there are only a handful listening to this show,
sure.
Dynamic means dynamic typing?
Dynamic means that the values have a type rather than the variables have a type.
So the variables can be typed, can be changed on the fly.
Yeah, in fact, usually you don't even declare what
you don't
the type
declare
of variable
it, right. is. So if you're and used this, to a strongly prototyped language like C or C++, this yes. is a little different. You just say, hey, I got a variable. His name is Merlin. And it could be a string. It could be an integer. It could change.
Well, now, carefully, you said strong typing. That's actually orthogonal to static
it's not related.
Dynamic typing.
Oh, okay.
So Perl and Smalltalk are
strongly
both strongly typed, but
right.
they're dynamic typed. Whereas something like C or C++ is static typed. It means the variables have the typing rather than the value. So I'm only arguing this on the axis of variable versus value typing, dynamic versus static typing. I actually argue for strong
typing. Doesn't it create sloppy programming?
No, it actually makes it a lot better, but we don't have a long time to go into this. Come see my talk.
I want to see your talk now. Yeah, no, and I'm very interested. And I'm naturally inclined towards languages like Python and Perl and Ruby. But I don't know if that's because of the typing.
Well, I have an explanation for why, but it exceeds the margins of this particular show.
How about Forth? Because I loved Forth.
Forth would be...
I think it was dynamic.
Forth has weak typing, actually, because you can take any byte and say, no, this is really... this is really a two-byte integer.
You can have
this
it be anything. Characters. It's just a stack,
really.
You know.
It's Forth is closer to assembly, where really everything's right. weakly typed. So I'm not arguing that that's any better.
You like strong typing, but dynamic.
Strong dynamic typing, yes. Okay. Just like me.
He's strong and dynamic.
Exactly.
Hey, I do want to mention before we get to our guest. Oh, well, let's talk about our guest. We're going to talk. I'm very excited about this. Ian Pratt is with Zen, X-E-N dot
yes.
org. What is Zen?
Zen is probably the leading virtualization platform. Virtualization is taking the hardware and putting a layer on top of it so that you can run an operating system. And the operating system doesn't know that it's not actually talking directly to the hardware. And one of the advantages of this is that you can run multiple instances of the same or different operating systems all on the same physical hardware. And we'll definitely have to ask Ian how that all works and what it's good for.
Sounds very well. And, you know, this is something everybody kind of knows about now because of products like VMware mm-hmm. and virtual PC and stuff. But this is a very interesting idea and it has some real long term implications, not just for people who want to run Windows on a Mac mm-hmm. or Linux on XP, but for cloud computing.
I think it has a lot to do with cloud computing. Yeah. We'll definitely get into that on the show.
Before we do, Summer of Code is now. The Summer of Code is about to get underway. The Google Summer of Code project for 2009. It's very exciting. Let me tell you a little bit about GSOC so you understand what we're talking about. It is a global program that offers student developers a chance to get paid to write code for open source projects. And you know, I know you've been a mentor, Randall, mm-hmm. and a lot of different some of the best open source programs have been mentor organizations for this. It's a really great thing. So now all the mentor organizations have already been chosen for 2009. In fact, all the students have already applied. So what I want to do is encourage you to consider being a mentor organization for the 2010 Summer of Code. Mm-hmm. The idea is to get more open source code created and released for the benefit of all. To inspire developers to not go right to designing derivatives for Wall Street, but think a little bit about what open source could mean to them, and give them an idea of what it means, what it's like to participate. Of course, it's great for open source projects; they can find new developers, new talent. And if you're studying computer science as a student, the chance to work to put Google Summer of Code on your resume, and to pursue your academic interests as opposed to flipping burgers over the summer. Is a really great opportunity. So if you're a potential mentor organization, pretty much every open source project has been a mentor organization, right? I mean, we're talking about Drupal a couple of weeks ago. What are some? Is Perl 6 part of this?
Perl's definitely got a number of people. In fact, I think at this point, I just saw an announcement that something like 8 or 9 students were accepted for the Perl Summer of Code.
Oh,
so that's really
great.
Nice. And Squeak also, 5 or 6 projects in the Squeak project as well. So I'll be definitely involved in both the Squeak and the Perl things, maybe sort of distantly, like helping the helpers, because I'm not actually formally signed up as a mentor this year, but there we go.
So here's all it takes to qualify. You have to be any group running an active, free, or open source software project. Python Software Foundation, for instance, or Perl. The project does not need to be legally incorporated. That's not a requirement. But you do have to produce and release software under one of the many approved open source initiative licenses, the OSI licenses, in order to participate. You can actually go online. If you go to code.google.com/SOC, you can see they've done this, it'll be their fifth year. So you can see previous applications, previous mentors, some ideas about that. If you do talk to anybody, tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. We want to make sure that they feel like they got their money's worth participating. They're sponsoring mm-hmm. Floss Weekly. Mm-hmm. And this is just, you know, I love Google. I mean, the fact that they're sponsoring Floss Weekly, they're sponsoring the Summer of Code, really shows their commitment to open source. They use a lot of open source, and I think this is the way you give back to the community. So thank you, Google, and thank you, mentor organizations, and check it out. You can go online. Just go to SOCGHOP.appspot.com, the Google Summer of Code. Mm-hmm. Now, Ian Pratt is on the line. Mm-hmm. Let's find out. You know me. I have the same stupid question I start every show with. Where are you calling from? Is it England? I think it's England. I get the feeling it's England.
No, I'm actually in the U.S. at the moment in Santa Clara.
So where is Zen quartered?
So the original work on Zen started in Cambridge, UK, which is it started a member of faculty at the University of Cambridge Computer Laboratory, and still many of the core team are in Cambridge. But it's a big community with folk working on Zen all around the world.
How long ago was that?
So the project really started in earnest in about 2001, but we'd been thinking, about sort of ideas around how to really make, to do virtualization properly on the PC architecture for a couple of years before then.
Your timing is good because, of course, now there's hardware support in the latest Intel chips.
Absolutely. And I think, we can take some credit for that, and that, with the work that we were doing in the university, we're really trying to, think through how you would go about doing virtualization on a on the PC architecture, and really get the best possible performance and the best security. And we really realized there were two parallel approaches we needed to take, and one was getting some help from the hardware, not just the CPU, but also from the chipset and the I/O devices as well. But then there's another part of that, which was actually to get some help from the software, from the operating system, and make some changes to the OS so that it's aware that it's running on in a virtualized environment. And by making those changes, you can get significant performance benefits. And also, it's important to let the OS know that it's running virtualized so that things like accounting of time that's given to processes that are running, or things like that, making sure that all works correctly.
So just to make sure that we're all on the same page for people at home, can you tell us a little bit about why you would want virtualization and what Zen is bringing to that picture?
Sure. So, Zen is a layer that runs on the bare metal of the machine, mm-hmm. and it effectively enables the machine to be divided up and then to run different operating system instances in each of those different partitions. And virtualization has a whole host of benefits. And it was first done in end of the 60s and in the 70s on machines like the IBM mainframes. And it's many of the same benefits and a whole lot more, which make virtualization important today. So
now, why would I do something virtual then? Why don't I just run it directly on the hardware? What's the advantage? So I can run multiple operating systems, maybe?
Well, that would be one use case, which would be very useful for developers or folk that need to run, multiple OSs to test software in different environments. But what's been the real driving factor driving force behind virtualization in the last few years has really been around server virtualization. And the idea there is that if you look in a typical data center, you might see hundreds or even thousands of machines. And if you were to look at the utilization of those machines, you might see that the actual CPU usage might be just a few percent. And what server consolidation using virtualization enables you to do is to actually take those virtual machines and to take things which were running on a physical machine, turn it into a virtual machine, and then run multiple of them on a single server. And hence you get these consolidation benefits, so that rather than having these OS instances just consuming a few percent, we can sort of add them all up together and make better use of a single machine. And that's really what made virtualization popular this time around, the fact that you can do more with the same amount of hardware, or perhaps even get rid of older hardware and replace it with a smaller number of machines. And obviously you're saving on the capital cost of the machines, but also the cost of running them.
Like an ISP might have a bunch of physical hardware, and then I would come in as a customer and rent essentially a slice of one of those machines. But to me, it would look like the entire machine. Would that be a typical case?
Sure, that's certainly something which ISPs and hosting providers do. It obviously gets used a lot inside corporate data centers, where all of the virtual machines may be owned by the same company, but they'll be consolidating them down onto some smaller number of servers. And it's this whole technique has become increasingly important as machines have got faster and faster, and with more and more cores added on a single CPU, that you find that a single operating system instance or a single application can't actually make use of that whole machine. So you use virtualization, put a layer of virtualization in there, run multiple virtual machines, and really make better use of that server.
Well, I was just going to ask though, if I have all the hardware myself, why would I take two different hosts and run it on one piece of hardware instead of just sort of putting them all on one? I mean, what benefit is the extra layer giving me then for that?
You can do that. That's an option. But oftentimes the vendor of those applications, that application may not actually want to support it if you install multiple in the same operating system. A lot of vendors will only do it if there's support the application if you have a single, if it's installed in a particular configuration.
Well, I can think of one geeky example and tell me if this is right. So, for example, if I'm installing Postgres, it may by default want to listen on the wildcard port 5422. And if I try to install two instances of Postgres, they're going to compete for the same port number. But if I install this in two separate virtual instances, I won't have that problem. Is that the kind of thing you're solving?
You planning on installing Postgres here? Boy, it didn't take very long abandoning MySQL. And boom, like that,
example,
just like that.
As an example.
Yeah. No, that would be an example of where, it would be difficult to install both instances in the same OS. But, even if you could get them installed, you may not want to for reasons of support. You may not want to for reasons of security. If you've got, mm-hmm. if you install a web server alongside some, sensitive corporate database, and the web server gets compromised, it's quite likely you're going to lose the security of the whole machine, and your corporate database gets compromised. So, oftentimes it really makes sense to have this siloed architecture, and that's very common in corporate data centers, where they just have a rule of one application per OS instance running on one piece of hardware, and then virtualization enables them to consolidate that by having one application per OS instance, but with a layer of virtualization, having many, many of them on a single piece of hardware.
So you would use this then to help solve these partitioning problems, both having separate applications not necessarily finding out about each other, and also if you're a net service provider, being able to sell it to customers in various slices. What's the penalty for doing that? I mean, are we slowing it way down for all sorts of I/O, or are we running full speed? What's the penalty for this?
Well, in the bad old days, you'd take a pretty severe performance hit for doing for adding that layer of virtualization in. But I think the Zen project can take a great deal of credit for bringing that overhead right down by promoting these changes in the hardware and mm-hmm. by making changes to the operating system. We've really got that overhead down really pretty small these days. And it's, I always get asked, what is the overhead? What's the number? And it's mm-hmm. very hard to say because it's very application dependent. But, for many applications, the overhead is a fraction of a percent You know, so small you just would never care about it. And a good example of that is running some Java, some Java workloads and other enterprise applications. We've seen overheads that really are just fractions of a percent. And there are other workloads which are more challenging, particularly things which are doing very heavy I/O. And to do a great job of virtualizing those, we actually could do with some help from the hardware. And that hardware help in the I/O devices is arriving now. And Zen has really been, the Zen community has been working hard to be able to get the support in and help the hardware vendors with designing their devices to be Zen friendly. And as a result, we can get great I/O performance too. So we've done demonstrations where you have, say, 10 gigabit network interfaces, and you're actually able to saturate that network interface receiving packets into a virtual machine. And that's something which you just couldn't do without some help from the hardware.
What's an example of that? I can imagine, like, for example, for an I/O call, you'd want to quickly get from the trapped virtual call all the way over to the real call and have it spend a minimum amount of time bundling and unbundling. Is that the kind of thing that would have to happen?
That's the kind of thing, yeah. And the kind of help you want from the hardware is, so that when a packet arrives from the arrives on the network, you actually want some help from the hardware to figure out which virtual machine it's actually going to be delivered to.
Then
in some cases, just as simple as putting it on a queue, which is specific to that virtual machine, so that we don't have to pick it all apart in software. That can be a big help. And so, oftentimes it's just little changes to the hardware that actually have a big impact on performance.
Now, when you started this, that kind of hardware support wasn't there, so this has slowly been improving over time?
Yeah, and in the very early days when this was a university project, we actually built some of the hardware that we needed to be able to make this stuff work well. And it's great that you can go out today and you can just buy that hardware.
So you've been involved since the beginning, right? So you started the Zen project?
Yeah, I was certainly there when we started it. I guess it was really myself and Keir Fraser who got the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. Keir is the guy that is the kind of lead developer, and he's the head maintainer of Zen today.
And what was the primary problem you were trying to solve at that point, or was this just a theoretical exercise?
No, it's interesting how we got into this. So it was part of a bigger university research project where we were, trying to figure out how we could have, servers, perhaps around the world or, in data centers that we could actually enable suitably authenticated members of the public or corporations to be able to buy resources on those servers in a very sort of fine-grained fashion. So being able to buy a fraction of a machine or, perhaps for quite short periods of time, and then be able to run whatever they want on it. So, we were trying to figure out how best to enable that. And that's how we got interested in virtualization. We thought that was a great way of enabling, people to package up their applications, and then be able to run it and make use of this service and, and pay for the resources that they're using. Mm-hmm. And, as opposed to having to rewrite their applications in Java or, make use of some sort of higher level virtualization, they could just take what they have and the operating system, submit it, and actually have it run on these machines. And of course, that's what we call cloud computing today. And the work we did in the university on this project called Xena servers, it was really a major forerunner to cloud computing. And certainly the folks at Amazon with their Elastic Compute Cloud service and many of the other cloud vendors sort of recognized some of the work which was done on in the Xena servers project, which Zen was actually just one part of that larger project. Mm-hmm. It's been quite instrumental to the way they're building cloud computing today. So, right from day one when we were designing Zen, we wanted to make sure it had great performance, because mm-hmm. if we were dividing the machine up, we didn't want to waste too much of it while we were dividing it up. But we also wanted to have great security and to really make sure that those different virtual machines couldn't interfere with each other, because we wanted to be able to sell one virtual machine to Coke and one virtual machine to Pepsi on the same machine. And for those guys to be comfortable, they're not going to be, you know, leaking corporate sensitive data between the two VMs.
Absolutely. This is great. So even from the beginning, you were thinking of how this would be used, like, I guess, commercially then.
Yeah, I think we, you know, we realized that this is going to be a pretty exciting area going, you know, that we certainly believe in what's now called cloud computing and, you know, trying to turn computing into, you know, into a utility that you could just, you know, buy resources on demand.
Do you know if Amazon is using Zen technology or something else or something similar?
Absolutely. So the whole of Amazon EC2 is, you know, is all built on Zen. That's, you know, many,
wow,
many thousands of Zen hosts.
Very, you know, interesting. That's how you came to know it, right, Randall? You were setting up, Open Solaris?
I'm moving my server over to EC2. And so this is part of, it's just, it's timely why, well, it's great that we're talking with Ian today, because it's like, oh, yeah, I'm moving to EC2 soon. So
Is it the only virtualization solution Amazon uses?
I don't know of any others. Certainly the whole of EC2 runs on Zen. You know, many of the biggest virtualization deployments in the world all run on Zen.
That's high praise.
I understand also that Google is using Zen internally for some of their compute clouds. Is that something you're aware of?
Yeah, I know that Google use it quite a bit internally. You know, as do many companies. You know, if you're, you know, if you want a virtualization, you know, platform which will, you know, scale to thousands of machines and, you know, is efficient and high security, then you know, Zen's a great choice.
Now, is that part of your? You have a commercial model around this? Then, are you selling support and services to these companies? I mean, you know, without mentioning specific customers, obviously, but is that sort of where you're eventually heading with this? Or is there some other profit model, some other commercial model that you want to do with Zen?
Well, you know, if you go back to 2004, we actually set up a company called ZenSource, which was really all of the lead developers who were working on Zen. We set that company up, and we built an enterprise ready version of Zen, where we basically built a whole lot of software on top to really enable it to compete directly, you know, with companies like VMware and their you know, virtual infrastructure product, and you know, ZenSource was selling that Zen server product line, and that was then acquired by Citrix in 2007. So that, you know, that product's going from strength to strength. The take up rate of it is is very fast indeed. It's really having a major impact on the server virtualization world.
And how would you compare that to something like VMware's product? Because I'm sure that's similar. What's the similarities and what's the differences?
You know, I think that it compares very favorably. I think that Zen has always had a reputation for great performance, great security, and you know, it's got this these days very competent, complete management stack built on top of it. You know, but it has the great advantage that it's the base product is free, and people can then deploy that on thousands of machines and then pay for support and services and other higher level software on top to enable them to manage large numbers of Zen instances to operate large data centers and be able to move workloads around and really be able to drive the maximum efficiency out of that data center.
Hmm. And what about comparing this to KVM? Is it similar, different?
So, you know, Zen is a true sort of type one, bare metal hypervisor. It's a thin layer which runs as the most privileged thing on the machine. It owns the hardware and then divides it up and enables other virtual machines to use it. You know, KVM is really just, you know, it's virtualization added to Linux. So if you're a, you know, a Linux desktop user, and you know, you just want to, you know, run a few virtual machines, then KVM provides a very convenient way of doing that. Whereas Xen is really about being part of the platform, you know, built into the hardware. I mean, if you buy servers from say HP and Dell, you know, give a couple of examples. You know, Xen can actually, you can actually, when you buy that server, choose to have Xen embedded in Flash on that machine. So when you turn the machine on, it's running virtualization. It's a property of the platform, and you know, that's quite different from thinking of virtualization as just being sort of an add-on to an operating system. And by having that tight integration with the hardware, it enables us to get, you know, great performance and, you know, and have that very high security architecture.
So something like KVM, you have a Linux kernel booted, and all of the other guest operating systems sort of have to go back to that first operating system through its independent layers before it can get to the hardware. But with something like Xen, it's going right down through the thin Xen layer to the hardware. Would that be a fair way to say the difference?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea. You you just have this thin layer, and you. You really try and keep that layer as thin as possible, so that you know, you want to only put the things which have to be there in that layer, because it's, you know, it is the most privileged thing in the system. You want to deprivilege everything else, just so you get those strong security boundaries.
And is that called like an engine? And what's that name from?
So yeah, Xen's often referred to as you know, the Xen engine, because it's. You know, the open source community collaborate on building this Xen engine, which then gets picked up by you know, lots of different vendors, and then built into you know, a wide variety of different products. So obviously some operating system vendors you know, pick it up and build it into, you know, Novell Linux or Oracle Linux. Also Sun build it into Solaris, but there are other vendors who you know, build it into their hardware platforms. And so obviously I mentioned HP and Dell, and, you know, and Citrix, you know, help those companies with their platform virtualization, building it in, you know, into the hardware, creating a platform. But also Xen crops up in all sorts of places these days. There are certain storage arrays you can buy that have Xen, you know, built into them. It's beginning to appear in things like routers. So it gets embedded a lot. And it's all the same core engine showing up in lots of different places. And also these days, you know, it's not just about servers. We're seeing Xen, you know, appearing on desktops and laptops. There are a number of different companies which are selling Xen, you know, on desktops and laptops. And even now it's moving into the things like mobile phones and, you know, smartphones, where you actually, you know, have virtualization on these ARM-powered devices. So Xen really does cover everything from the very big to the very small. You know, these huge i64 supercomputers with you know, hundreds of CPUs. You know, through you know, x86 servers, desktops, laptops, and now even mobile phones.
And this is the hypervisor that's talking directly to the hardware and has some sort of API so that the sort of the, what do you call it, the domain zero operating system can speak to it, and also all the guest operating systems, right?
Yeah, that's right. So you have this, you know, this core engine, and then it, you know, gets built into lots of different things.
And this part of it's still open source. Actually, what part of Xen isn't open source?
Well, the whole of Xen is open source. You know, the various products which different vendors build on top of it, not all of them are completely open source. You know, some are, but some obviously have proprietary stuff on top.
Mm-hmm.
But and, you know, the whole of the Xen engine is open source.
And how does that relationship work with, say, with the Xen Source company and with the community then? Is there, are there people outside of Xen Source proper that have commit bits and help you with things, or is it all still pretty much controlled from within? And how, what's the flow of that work like?
So, you know, it works like many open source projects in that there are maintainers of subsections of the Xen project, and we have a mailing list, and you know, hundreds of patches get posted each week to that mailing list, And then the relevant maintainers, pick up the patches and engage in discussion and then check them in. It's the usual open source model where it's all about the code.
Are you using a distributed version control system like Git or something already?
Yeah, we actually use Mercurial.
Okay.
I guess some bits are now Git, but we've been using Mercurial for quite a while, and certain things are now transitioning to Git.
Yeah, and is this mostly C code, or is it? I guess a lot of it's got to be assembly, like x86 assembly and things like that, right?
Yeah, it's a real mix. A whole bunch of different languages which are in used in different components of Xen. So obviously the various very low level bits are all assembler and C. There are parts of the tool stack which are actually written in Python. And also pretty interestingly, there's a few components now which are a part of the main project which are actually written in a programming language called OCaml, which you may not have heard of.
Is that related to OPerl?
No. It's a strongly typed language of some kind, right? Yes.
Yeah, it's a very cool strongly typed, compiled programming language which folk in the university in Cambridge and a number of other companies. I mean, it's actually used by in a surprising number of places. Have found that OCaml is a great way of writing, of helping you write more robust programs and with higher security and also speeding development time. Interestingly, it's what Microsoft have adopted for their their F# programming language, which is now part of Visual Studio 2008. Mm-hmm. F# is basically a camel with slightly different syntax. So anyway, we think that a camel is actually going to be, or F# is going to be very popular because it's worked out really well for us.
Just enough different syntax that Microsoft can own their piece of it, like J# and C#.
Never seen them do that before, right? Yeah.
No, never heard of that before, no.
Well, I'm told that their compiler takes the original syntax too, so.
There we go. There's the porting capability. What's the Xen client initiative?
So, Xen has obviously been very well established on server for quite a while, but over the last couple of years, there have been a whole group of vendors that have been working together to prepare Xen for running on desktops and laptops, and also looking at things like mobile phones too. So the Xen Client Initiative was created to as a forum for the vendors to cooperate in trying to accelerate that effort. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of releases of Xen client support, and it's in various shipping products today from companies like Phoenix and Lenovo are shipping products which have Xen built in on desktops and laptops, and a number of startup companies as well.
Are we going to see that on an Apple laptop soon?
Well, that's certainly technically possible, but we'll have to see what Apple want to do.
Because I think it would be sort of cool. I mean, I'm running VMware on my laptop to get some virtualization, also running a VirtualBox, and it would be nice to have something that was closer to the hardware like Xen and a lot more open source that way too.
I'd be willing to venture that probably the most people who are using virtualization on the desktop are Apple users trying to run Windows. I mean, that's certainly it's certainly brought to people's awareness.
Yeah, how well does Windows run under Xen as a client operating system?
I mean, it runs absolutely great. A lot of effort has been put into to making Windows run really well on Xen, and a whole bunch of other operating systems as well. Solaris runs great, all of the various BSDs and so forth. Even things like Novell NetWare run great on Xen. So, but Windows has been a particular focus, and you can run Windows 2008 or Vista, and it runs really well, and actually thinks it's running on Hyper-V, the Microsoft hypervisor, because we implemented some Hyper-V compatibility so that you can just take a virtual machine which has been created on Hyper-V and move it across to Xen, and it will run just fine unmodified on Xen, and probably run with considerably better performance than it would have done on on Hyper-V right now.
Oh, very cool. Speaking of migration, that's one of the other things I found interesting as I was researching this, that you can actually take a process and slowly or quickly migrate it to another machine and flip it all at the last second and just have it be running in its new location without it knowing that it got moved. How does that work?
Right. It's a process called live relocation, where you take a virtual machine which is running on one physical server, and you... as it continues to run, you synchronize it over an image of that virtual machine over to another physical server. So as it's running, any changes which are occurring, you're also shipping over to that secondary server. And then when that secondary server has got a complete copy of the virtual machine, you just stop it on the original server and then unpause it on the secondary server, on the second server, and then that virtual machine will just carry on running. All of the network connections, any database transactions, whatever it was that virtual machine was doing, will just continue seamlessly on that second machine.
Because it would have the same, you could even have the same MAC address on the Ethernet then, right? I mean, you really could just make it virtually the same box somewhere else.
Yeah, wow. Absolutely. It just all moves across. And so, that's great if... there are a whole bunch of circumstances where you want to do that. Like supposing you've got a machine where a fan is failing and you want to take it down for maintenance, or you just evacuate all the virtual machines off it onto different physical servers, service the machine, power it back up again, and then you can just rebalance those virtual machines around your pool of physical servers. That's one example. Another situation might be supposing you realize that your data center, if you look at the utilization of all your physical servers, you realize that you've got spare capacity. So what you might want to do is to evacuate the virtual machines or move the virtual machines off some physical servers so you can power them down so that you can actually save power. Mm-hmm. And then when the workload increases, perhaps at the start of the business day, you power up new servers and then redistribute the workload. And that live relocation, or Zen motion as it's sometimes called, enables you to do that.
That's neat.
You could also, for example, I think if I read this correctly, save something down to disk and restart it so that it appears, except for the time of day changing all of a sudden, that would never happen either, right?
Yeah, no, you can certainly do things like that. So it's very common to take snapshots of virtual machines. Before you install some new piece of software, you might take a snapshot, install the piece of software, try it out, and either be it, makes it very easy to roll back to the previous snapshot that you have, or stay with the new version. It's a very convenient way of capturing the whole state of the system.
Yeah, this is what EC2 does. Is this what they mean when they're talking about snapshotting? Is this really the process they're using in a Zen snapshotting?
Yeah, when they're taking a snapshot, they're typically just talking about taking snapshots of the disks, but you can take a full snapshot of the execution state of the machine as well, and then be able to roll it forwards or backwards to that given point in time.
Wow, it's way cool, very cool, very fun. And I understand that speaking of timely and timing, that you've got Zen 3.4 coming out soon. What's different about that?
Yeah, so Zen 3.4 should be shipping in a few weeks' time. It's currently, I think, at release candidate 2. Still a few bugs to fix, but making good progress on them. And, there are a whole bunch of features in that release. There's a lot of work being done on the Zen client, about some advanced power management stuff that's gone in there. Also, some cool graphics support and stuff like that. On the server side, there's been a whole load of work on reliability and serviceability, availability and serviceability features. So, when you've got these big servers, trying to keep them up and running, even if they're actually suffering from hardware faults. So, if you've got memory units in a server, or particular banks of memory which are failing, then rather than just losing the whole machine, we now have the ability to recover from from certain failures where, if a given area of memory has become corrupted, you can just either kill that virtual machine and keep all of the others running, or sometimes even be able to inject the fact that this fault has occurred into that virtual machine and make its own, let it make its own decision about whether that area of memory that has become corrupted is crucial to it or not. So a whole bunch of features which are all really designed about about very high reliability and keeping the system running.
Wow.
There's kind of two examples of features that are going into this release.
And I presume that you have a roadmap of stuff beyond 3.4 and everything else you want to accomplish here. What's the big missing right now? I mean, if you had like 100 more programmers to throw at this, what would be the next big thing that you'd want to have Xen be able to do that it doesn't?
I think, we have a great roadmap of stuff coming down the pipe, because one of the things which is really cool about Xen is, it started in a university and still has a lot of connections with universities, an awful lot of research which is done on Xen, both in universities and in other sort of commercial research labs. And so there's always this great pipeline of stuff which is being written about and then finds its way into mainline Xen. And so you can look to some of the things which are being worked on in a university context, and that gives you a pretty clear idea of where the project is going. So to give an example, one feature which is likely to be in the next release is around what's called hardware fault tolerance. So mm-hmm. whereas with live relocation, you're running a virtual machine on one physical server, and then you decide that you want to move it off to another server. And mm-hmm. That synchronization process may take tens of seconds, but then the switchover is instant. But with fault tolerance, you actually run both virtual machines together on the two servers. And then if you just walk up to one of the servers and pull the plug out the back, the virtual machine will just continue seamlessly on that secondary server. Mm. So, that's kind of true hardware fault tolerance. And one of the great things about the open source community, there are actually four different implementations of fault tolerance, hardware fault tolerance, software implemented hardware fault tolerance for Xen, of which two are really quite mature. Project called Remus and a project called Kamari. And there's a lot of discussion going on between the developers behind those projects to figure out what the best ideas from each are, so that we really get the best of both worlds solution, because they're taking quite different approaches, and each solution works better in different use cases. So the combined solution should really just be the best thing out there, and certainly surpasses any other implementations that may exist.
And this is one of the great things about open source, is that if this had been a proprietary product, you would have to have hired all of those researchers in-house to make this kind of change and upgrade. You wouldn't even necessarily have two competing solutions that are sort of looking to see which is the best and maybe taking the best of both worlds. So you're finding, I would presume then, that having this be an open source cooperative community project, you're getting a lot of eyeballs on this that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise, correct?
Yeah, for sure. People can look at both implementations and both sets of benchmarks and so forth and figure out what the right thing to do is.
Well, and even being able to look at the original source code and figure out that there is something to be done. I mean, we see a way to make fault tolerance on top of this if we just had access to the source code. In fact, boom, there you have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool. This is really amazing. So there's still a lot of cooperation then, collaboration between universities and Xen Source and the commercial products that various companies
with
are putting out?
The whole Xen community, yeah. There's it's a big developer community. It's continuing to grow. Look at numbers of patch submissions and number of folks who come to the various developer summits. And, we're actually having to organize more summits in different locations. It used to be that we'd have the summits in North America because most of the developers were in North America. But these days, there are large numbers of contributors in Japan and China. So we had developer summits in Japan last year. We're having one in China this year. And also, events in Europe and even South America now. So,
wow,
it really has taken off.
And where did the name Xeno Server come from?
Right. Well, the name it's kind of interesting. So the Xeno part of the name, if you think about what we were trying to do, we were trying to provide a service where you could invite paying customers, paying guests onto your machine and provide them with resources, but you don't necessarily trust them. And so Xeno actually comes from the name of the Greek traveler who you might invite into your home to provide food and sustenance, but you wouldn't necessarily trust. So that's where the Xeno and Xeno servers came from. And then Zen is just a contraction of that.
Actually, I heard there's a story about that, something about you guys standing around a water cooler one day. You want to tell that story?
I'm not sure I know that story.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw it on your paper. What says Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Right, it's just a good name. It doesn't have to have a story.
It's a very similar name for that.
From the book, one of the first papers which was written on Zen was called Zen and the Art of Virtualization.
I like it.
The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
And this Xeno, that's the same Xeno that I'd find in the word xenophobe, to be afraid of everyone.
It's just logical. You'd add an O. And.
Yep. Okay. Very cool. Yeah.
You know, really, this stuff, when you look at EC2 and the way Zen's used there, this stuff really empowers a whole set of developers now to work in cloud computing and create businesses and at a very low cost, very effective, very flexible situation. I mean, this is kind of a very powerful project you've got here.
Yeah, I think it's a core piece of infrastructure.
Were you thinking about cloud computing when you designed it?
Well, yeah, as I said, the Xeno Servers project was really a forerunner to cloud computing. So it was very much on our mind. This is what we really built Zen for, was solving this particular problem.
Yeah, very exciting.
Cool.
It's a revolution. We're in the middle of it right now. And Zen, I was just reading an article with the CTO at Amazon. He's a big Zen proponent. You can see how excited they are about using Zen. Now, the Citrix sale, is that going to change anything?
Well, that's quite a while ago now. It was 18 months ago.
Okay, so if it were going to change anything, it would have changed it.
Yeah, whenever there's a change, when we first set up ZenSource in 2004, there's always a certain amount of apprehension in the within the Zen community. Are things going to change? But at the end of the day, it's the same. The same set of guys, and it's a much bigger community now. It's not dependent on on the original original developers, and I think that with the community has just gone from strength to strength, and more companies, more individuals, and it's a fun project to work on. Lots of tough programming problems to solve.
Yeah. And has your code been migrating into Citrix's other products? What is the relationship?
Well, certainly Zen is a core, virtualization is a core technology which gets applied to a number of other Citrix products as well. So, we've talked about server virtualization and running multiple server operating systems, but you can also use it to run multiple desktop operating systems like Windows XP. And, Citrix, for example, has a product called Zen Desktop, which is using Zen to actually give each user a given virtual machine, say running Windows XP or Vista, and then to run that in the data center and then just remote the display to some thin client device sitting in front of the user's desk. And so, there are a number of products which Citrix has which make use of Zen. Hmm.
I only ask that because they're a sponsor of many of our shows, and I just want just curious how much Zen advertising we're doing. Maybe we're doing quite a bit.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ian. It's really been great talking to you and finding out more about Zen. Sounds like it's been a great project.
Yeah, it's there's never a dull moment. There's lots of cool stuff happening.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Do you have an opinion, having now been acquired by a commercial company on what the people at MySQL have gone through, now being bought by Sun and now looks like being bought by Oracle? Any advice for them?
Well, I guess every situation's different. I think we've been very lucky with being acquired by Citrix and being allowed to you know, kept a lot of independence, being able to get on doing what we do best. And I don't know what the situation's been like at my school, but probably haven't had quite the same flexibility.
As Kay Shep said, they're really glad they paid attention to their licensing right about this point. Zen, I'm sorry, you might have covered this. GPL3, what was his license for Zen?
It's the core Zen is all GPL V2. You know, there are different licenses we use for different components, depending on what we're trying to do. If we want to have a component which we want to be picked up and incorporated into every operating system on the planet, you know, we make that BSD to help that to happen.
Right.
There are other components which might be LGPL because we want people to be able to add proprietary stuff into that. But really, the core engine is GPL V2.
Hmm. One of our chat rooms, actually in front feed, Leo Novelli asks, you touched on this a little bit, but is there a difference between Zen's hypervisor and the Citrix Zen server? Why should one pick one over the other, I guess, is this question.
Right. Well, it's all based on the same core Zen engine, but Citrix Zen server has a bunch of software built on top of that, which then adds in additional functionality to do with managing sets of servers and for doing all of the kind of features which then enables it to compete head on with VMware's products. And there is a free version of Zen server which you can pay for support for, and you can download that, and it's a pretty cool product.
So you're getting the management utilities, you're getting the yep. ease of use when you pay for it.
Exactly. Yeah. Ease of use is a big one, actually, because setting up virtualization can be a little tricky, but just having a CD, you pop in and pop in the drive and install just makes it a lot easier, and having a nice GUI for setting everything up.
Sure.
Definitely. Well, Ian, I know you have to run off to the airport real quick here, so I really appreciate the time you've taken out of your day today and talking with us.
That's been fun. Thanks.
Very good.
Ian Pratt of ZenXEN.org. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
All right, we're going to hang up now, and we'll talk about you behind your back.
Exactly.
Safe flight, Ian. Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.
I stayed out of that because I had nothing to say, Randall. I hope you'll forgive me.
Oh, you know, Leo, you always have interesting things to say to come in every once in a while. You said a couple of good things in there, so it's nice.
Thank you. I was trying not to be dumb like, some person off the street.
No, it's all very good. But it's really great how, really he had the foresight to sort of precede.
What did he say, 2001 they started this?
This whole thing about cloud computing. I mean, cloud computing before clouds were cool.
Right.
I mean, we'd been drawing clouds on internet diagrams for years, but it took a long time for somebody to say, hey, let's put a computer up in there.
Well, tell me why is virtualization, you've been working with it, and I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why is virtualization so critical to something like EC2 or just cloud computing in general?
Well, because it's really that disconnection between the hardware and the things that are running on it. Like Ian talked about, being able to migrate a running process off of a piece of hardware that's about to fail, bringing it up, and also using slices of things. I mean, when I'm buying, an EC2 small instance, I'm using probably only one quarter of an actual CPU. And so it's silly to rent me an entire box like my current ISP is doing, where, there's a lot of idle cycles on the machine that's currently running Stonehenge.com. I'm looking at a load average of approximately 0.4 right now as I'm staring at it. There's no reason that the ISP shouldn't be able to sell that other 0.6 to somebody else.
Right.
Because it's just idle CPU. It's just burning and counting an idle loop at the lowest levels of Unix, which, how many times do you need to count to a billion? I mean, it's really kind of pointless.
Well, and you touched on this, really. It's divorcing your software from your hardware.
Exactly.
And so, you can throw more servers at it. You can move it to a different server. It all is transparent to the user. That's what cloud computing really is. It's not about the hardware. You don't know or care what you're running on.
Well, it's also like, if I were to need, say, 8 virtual IPs to run my business, but all of a sudden needed 16, the Zen layer in between, as far as I understand it, will sort of isolate that and present itself as 16 hardware interfaces to my box and or to my virtual box, and it would just work. Yeah. Also, it means I can take
my existing disk layout, everything that I own, and push one button, and a few seconds later, I'm running on a machine that's twice as fast, because this is the kind of stuff we can do in EC2, is if I need a machine that's twice or three times as fast, I can play 20 cents a minute or 40 cents a minute instead of 10 cents a minute, and I just run my exact image migrated over as needed if I've got some compute-intensive things to do for a few hours.
Yeah,
this is really amazing stuff. It's just getting that way, and you know, and Google using this stuff for their app engine stuff. It's all very and also their internal computing power. It's just great because it means we can bring this stuff up on and off. It's very very nice. So yeah, very, yeah. Very cool that we're doing that. So yeah, very
what
cool.
A neat project. Absolutely. And you think that now my sense is that Xen, of course, is a great, it works well as a great core, but it's maybe a little harder to use than some of the commercial choices like VMware.
Well, it's always, there's probably an open source component to it that requires a little bit of hand-holding, some sort of first-level support from the community. And this is why companies like, you know, Citrix and will commercialize this and add a layer to it and say, look, we'll provide, you know, 24/7 phone coverage and things like that to really help you get it up and running for your business. I mean, if it's just me running a rack of a couple of machines and maybe five virtual servers on that, I might get by with community service. Community support like that, but clearly, if I'm going to be an ISP that's going to put, you know, 200 racks of boxes of machines, I'm certainly going to be buying, you know, the commercial level support for stuff like that, or at least bring in the expertise in house so that I can eventually migrate off of that as well.
Very cool.
Yep. So, shall we talk about who's coming up next?
Well, I guess. Who's coming up next, Randall Schwartz?
Well, next week. I've been waiting for this for a while. When we had our friend Aaron Newcomb on a few weeks back, and he talked about that one of the things he was working with is producing his video podcast completely using open source software. He mentioned the Cinelera software, which is the open source video editing suite.
Full and I had never heard of it. I never heard of it.
So he is coming on next week to talk about Cinelera. I think he may even be in studio. We're still working out the details.
Well, that would be fun.
In studio.
Great.
To show Cinelera off actually in studio there so the people that are watching us tape. Now, when do we tape, Leo?
We tape every, I'm thinking,
I can't remember anymore.
Every Thursday. We've changed the time. We moved it up ahead. Wednesday, so every Wednesday at 4:30 Eastern, 1:30 Pacific, 18:30 UTC. We moved it up half an hour. So if you'd like to watch while we make this live, it's a little confusing because we often do multiple shows. We do it out of order. If you prefer to have everything nice and orderly, wait for the podcast to download on your iTunes.
Then you won't get to see Aaron guiding you through stuff, which will be more
it's
fun
really nice. I have to say, if you're really interested, it is nice to watch it live. And we should mention that I do repeats. After we record a show, usually for a day or two after, it'll get in a repeat rotation that'll show air several times over the next 24 hours. So it's a little hit or miss on that. I haven't figured out a way to do a schedule. Maybe somebody wants to write an open source IPTV scheduling application. I'd be glad to use it. But
maybe written in Seaside. Maybe I just need to do that as our project working on together.
Getting fancy on me now.
And following after Cinelera, we have OpenMoco. For Christopher Hall's going to talk about OpenMoco and talk about what they're doing now that they won't be having that one phone application, but at least
all that hardware stuff that was slowing them down.
Still happening there. And then following that immediately is Bug Labs. So the guy's talking about some open source hardware with Bug Labs.
Oh,
that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And also coming out a few weeks later, we've got Tim O'Reilly of O'Reilly Media and O'Reilly Everything's coming on the show. That'll be a really great special show.
I'm
looking forward to that.
He is one of the most interesting fellows. Very quick, very laser focused on this stuff. And I think smart as heck.
And always, if you want to know the upcoming schedule, you can go to twit.tv/floss. You can find ways to contact me there and see what kind of shows we've got coming up. And I'm still taking new suggestions all the time. We have a new email address, as we introduced last week. You can now write me without remembering all the complex things of Merlin and Stonehenge. Just write to floss@twit.tv, and you'll get right into my inbox.
Yay, floss. Yeah. At twit.tv. Well,
it just gets simpler than that, man.
It's easy to remember, isn't it?
I know. Now I'll get even more mail. But that's great. I love talking to you guys. I love people writing me and saying how cool the show is. It always gives me a little smile during the day. So thank you very much, guys.
It's basically his only reward for doing this show. So you might want to send him an email every once in a while just to cheer him up as he looks at his empty pay packet each week.
Indeed.
Actually, we got a little money thanks to Google. Yeah. We really appreciate them. Don't forget, if you're a potential mentor for next year's Summer of Code, to check him out online at socghop.appspot.com. And somebody pointed out in the chat room, of course, don't forget, we also make these videos available at OddTV at odtv.me. They capture it and they put it up online, and we're going to get a little more professional in that. We're going to get opens and closes and blah, blah, blah. And, we had a great conversation with the Blip TV last week on Net at Night. And I am going to I'm thinking about, one of the things you can do is, if we upload the video to blip.tv after our community polishes it up a little bit, it can be viewed, embedded, and downloaded on iTunes. So I really do want to make it possible for people to watch the video as well as the audio, because you're such a good looking fella.
Yeah, okay. Always.
And I'm just one sweaty son of a gun, so that's
at least we
part
our hair the same way. That was the important part.
Very important.
Almost like twins.
Randall Schwartz, great to talk to you. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.